Woodrow Wilson decided to attend the peace talks taking place in France at the end of World War I, but the U.S. Constitution does not provide for any transfer of power to the vice president when the president leaves the country. Lord Bryce had concluded from his study of the Constitution that it seemed impossible for the president to leave the United States, and no head of state wanted Wilson to attend the peace conference. Woodrow Wilson had made a speech on January 8, 1914, where he outlined 14 points he deemed necessary for a lasting peace. Most people in the world thought this would be the basis of the peace accord. But it soon became clear that this would not be the case because many allies had made secret arrangements during the war which affected boundaries, territories, and other matters. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States, Premier Lord George of Great Britain, and Premier George Clemenceau of France were known as the Big Three because they almost completely controlled the course of the negotiations, although there were 29 other countries involved, and the United States Senate did refuse to sign the treaty, and we made a separate treaty with Germany, but not until 1921. Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, said that the international bankers swept statesman, politician, journalist, and jurist all to one side and issued their orders with the imperiousness of absolute monarchs. The peace conference climax divided up 1,132,000 square miles of land, and that's equivalent to about a third the size of the United States. This also meant some 17 million people had been handed over to the victorious Allies. The British Empire controlled 17 million square miles of land before World War I. That's nearly six times the size of the United States, and this did not include the semi-colonial area of China. At the close of World War I, Great Britain, through the peace conference, took another 1,415,929 square miles of land from Germany. During the years from 1925 to 1938, she took another 1,145,764 square miles of land, not necessarily from Germany, but a lot of it in the Middle East. 8,156,475 people were acquired by the British Empire, along with 862,549 square miles of land. The French Empire grew by 38,168 square miles of land and 5,568,191 people, while Belgium obtained 3,500,000 people from Rwanda-Urundi. The Belgians should not have been qualified to run any colony after their dismal record in the Congo. And if you think any of these newly acquired people had any voting rights in these various Allied countries, you better think again. During a discussion about what mandates Italy might get from the breakup of the Turkish Empire, they consulted the wording of the peace agreement to make sure they were following the correct procedures. One of them read aloud the lines that a mandate required the consent and wishes of the people concerned. Everyone laughed heartily, and Premier Orlando of Italy's eyes filled with tears of mirth. The old Austrian Empire was balkanized without respect to its various cultures and nationalities. East Prussia was separated from Germany by a large area ceded to Poland. Czechoslovakia took over the Saar Valley, which is very rich in coal, and it was to be administered for 15 years, then by the League of Nations, and after that it was to be held by a plebiscite. The Weimar Republic was forced upon the German nation, and the middle classes were robbed of their savings. France and Belgium discovered that Germany had $570 million in gold in its Berlin vaults. When the armistice agreement was renewed on December 13th, that gold was the only subject discussed. The commissioners added an amendment prohibiting Germany from disposing of this hard money for food or anything else to make sure it was available for reparations. The treaty deprived Germany of 21% of its corn and potato crops, and a third of its coal was given to France. Millions were unemployed. Rosa Luxemburg and her husband and a group of Jews in Germany took over the government for 3 days. Jews happened to be maybe 98% of the communists in Europe at that time. In fact, when the Kaiser ended the war, he fled to Holland because he thought the communists were going to take over Germany as they did in Russia, and that he was going to meet the same fate that the Tsar had met in Russia, so he left and went to Holland for safety and security. The American soldiers found they liked dealing with the Germans much better than they liked dealing with the French. The cost of the war to all participants totaled 3 times the value of all property in Germany. In 1921, the Reparations Commission, appointed by the Peace Conference, announced that Germany had to pay $132 billion in gold marks. To show they meant business, the Commission demanded 1 billion marks within 25 days. The Germans made the first payment, but the succeeding installments were another story. Their bitterness and rage over the Treaty of Versailles impelled them to allow inflation to run wild, hoping to pay off the reparations and depreciated marks. The device escalated out of control until in November 1923, it took 4.2 trillion marks to equal a single dollar. In 1919, a German man had deposited 50,000 marks in a German bank, hoping to retire on the interest from the deposit. In 1922, the bank sent the man a check for 250,000 marks and a letter stating that they were closing his account because it was too small. The stamp to mail the letter had cost the bank 8.5 million marks. Germany had lost much territory, had to pay enormous reparations, and was so restricted in her internal affairs that their first representatives to the peace talks resigned after they found out what the treaty was all about. What really infuriated the Germans was the French occupation of their homeland. The French force consisted of some 25,000 troops from Senegal and French Morocco. These soldiers had black and brown skin, and the Germans said they were selected to humiliate them. Newspapers printed stories of mass rapes of German women that exceeded the Wellington House's stories about the audacities committed in 1914 Belgium. France was afraid that the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian and Russian empires would end with military satellites on Germany's borders, so the French poured soldiers and weapons into Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. Soon, all the soldiers stationed in these countries were shooting at each other. The LA Times said that it is quite impossible to tell what the war made the world safe for. The Prime Minister of Britain, David Lloyd George, wrote that by the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1919, and the Treaty of Saint-Germain on September 20, 1919, the German people were thoroughly humiliated. Also, Wilson was so eager to see a League of Nations established that he compromised many of the points he had outlined in his 14-point speech. As a result, most of the provisions of the treaty came nearer the desires of Britain and France than they did to Wilson's vision. From his sickbed in New York City's hospital, where he was being treated for general exhaustion and rheumatism from his efforts in the congressional election campaign, Theodore Roosevelt issued a statement in which he stated that Mr. Wilson and his 14 points, and his 4 supplementary points, and his 5 complementary points have ceased to have any shadow of right to be accepted as expressive of the will of the American people. Wilson was for freedom of the seas, but let the British strangle American commerce with Europe in the name of their infamous blockade and abandon freedom of the seas. He proclaimed self-determination as a great principle and then gave away chunks of German-speaking Europe to Czechoslovakia, Poland, Italy, and France, sowing the seeds of the next war. Even though Austria and Germany wanted to unite, Wilson wrote into the Treaty of Versailles an article barring the Union no matter how the Austrians voted. The French premier, when he was speaking of Wilson, said that he never saw a man talk more like Jesus Christ and act more like David Lloyd George. David Lloyd George said that Wilson believed in mankind but distrusted all men. And John Maynard Keynes, in his book, Consequences of the Peace, stated that, quote, "The president was not a hero or a prophet. He wasn't even a philosopher, but a generously intentioned man lacking intellectual equipment." And Woodrow Wilson, don't forget, had been president of Princeton University before becoming president of the United States. The Italian minister Pantaleone said that Woodrow Wilson is a type of peckinsniff who has now disappeared amid universal execration. President Kennedy said that Wilson had made a botch of his Mexican intervention in 1914, edged the United States into World War I for narrow legalistic reasons, and catastrophically messed up the fight for the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations. This was not, he said, the record of a great president. The wartime blockade on Germany remained in force after the shootings had stopped and the peace negotiations were continuing. Hoover discovered that the German people were suffering from chronic malnutrition. The grain harvest, normally 30 million tons, had fallen to 16 million because of bad weather and the lack of hands to harvest it. In North Germany, 800 adults were dying of starvation every day. The Allies accused Hoover of shipping food from the United States because American coal storage warehouses were overcrowded with pork and dairy products. Hoover issued a statement calling for a relaxation of watertight blockade. He warned that otherwise anarchy would reign and there would be no government to make peace with and no one to pay for the damage done to Belgium and France. When Hoover got to London, he was not able to believe it when a high British official in the Food Ministry told him to stop making public statements about the blockade. This same British official explained that Lloyd George waged his re-election campaign on the Make the Hun Pay platform. They even forbid the German Baltic fishing fleet to catch so much as a herring, depriving them of a source of food they had depended on throughout the war. When Wilson proposed to put Germany's merchant marine at Hoover's disposal to ship food, the Allies forbade it because the Allies wanted to seize the ships for their merchant fleets. They claimed it was necessary to alleviate a world shipping shortage caused by the depredations of the German U-boats. But there was no shortage. The British and Americans had replaced 90% of the tonnage the Germans had sent to the ocean's bottom. The Allies wanted the German merchant fleet, which had been omitted from the armistice accords. The Germans were willing to give up their fleet, but then France stipulated that the Germans could not pay for the food by raising money with their exports. The impasse continued for 2 months, while tens of thousands of men, women, and children died of starvation and malnutrition in Germany and Austria. The Allies organized a Supreme Council of Supply and Relief with Hoover as its head. At the first meeting on July 11, 1919, the delegates informed Hoover that not a pat of butter or a peck of wheat would go to Germany until it surrendered its merchant fleet. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Orlando announced plans to investigate how much food Germany needed and how much reparations it could pay. Hoover was not invited to that meeting. Hoover did manage to get an agreement to ship food to neutral countries around Germany, such as Denmark and the Netherlands, where it could be traded for German commodities. Then the officials of Britain, France, and Italy revoked permission to ship food to neutral countries. They also canceled orders for 200 million pounds of American bacon already cured. They canceled contracts for 100 million bushels of wheat and large orders of beef, pork, and dairy products. Now the Allies could claim they had no food to spare for Germany, and the United States was stuck with the surplus. The following description of German children in one city was sent back by a member of Hoover's mission. He said that you think this is a kindergarten for little ones? No. These are children of 7 and 8 years, tiny faces with large, dull eyes overshadowed by huge, puffed, rickety foreheads. Their small arms are just skin and bones, and above the crooked legs with their dislocated joints, the swollen stomachs of the hunger edema. One British journalist described the scene in a German hospital as rows of babies feverish from want of food, exhausted by privation to the point where the little limbs were like slender wands, their expression hopeless, their faces dull and full of pain. Francesco Nitti, the Prime Minister of Italy, wrote later, "It will remain forever a terrible precedent in modern history that against all pledges, all precedents, and all traditions, the representatives of Germany were never even heard. Nothing was left to them but to sign a treaty at a moment when famine and exhaustion and threat of revolution made it impossible not to sign. In the cold canon law of the Church, it was laid down that everyone must have a hearing, even the devil. But the new Society of Nations did not even obey the precepts of the Dark Middle Ages held sacred on behalf of the accused. Based on evidence he had seen from officers sent to Germany by his War Office, Minister of War Winston Churchill issued a statement stating, there was grave danger of the entire collapse of the vital structure of German social and national life under the pressure of hunger and malnutrition. The peace conference, instead of being a peace without victory and self-determination like Wilson had spoke of, culminated in a crushing defeat of Germany with reparations and sufferings the like of which man's imagination cannot encompass. At this same time, back in the United States, Paul Warburg resigned as governor from the Federal Reserve in 1918 and was replaced by Albert Strauss, partner of the International Banking House of J&W Seligman. J&W Seligman was the bank that financed the revolution that separated Panama from Colombia so we could put through the Panama Canal. Both these men were at a secret meeting of the Federal Reserve that was held in 1920 when the agricultural depression of 1920 was planned. One of the main lies fed to the American people in 1913 was the promise that the Federal Reserve would take care of the American farmer. Harvard economist writing in the Quarterly Journal of Economics in February of 1914 said that the purpose of the Federal Reserve Act was to make sure that there will always be an available supply of money and credit in this country to meet universal banking requirements. There is nothing in that wording to help the farmer. The First World War gave this country general prosperity by the increase in the amount of money in circulation. It was the Federal Reserve System's duty to get back the vast amount of money and credit which had escaped their control during the time of prosperity. This was accomplished by the agricultural depression of 1920 and 1921. The Federal Reserve System set up the depression first by purchasing government securities under the leadership of Eugene Mayer to have money to purchase war materials. They also had a tremendous increase purchasing bankers and trade acceptances. Beginning in 1913, the Federal Reserve bank rates had gone from 6% down to 4% in 1914, and further down to 3% by 1916, where they stayed until 1920, further fueling inflation. Inflation was allowed to run its course in the United States as well as Europe in 1919 and 1920. The purpose of the inflation in Europe was to cancel out a large portion of the war debt owed by the Allies to the American people. The reason in this country for the low interest rates was for floating the billion-dollar Liberty loans. At the beginning of each Liberty loan drive, the Federal Reserve Board put $100 million into the New York money market through the open market operation in order to provide a cash impetus for the drive. This was done to soak up the increase in circulation of the medium of exchange brought about by the large amount of currency and credit put out during the war. As you may recall, when the Federal Reserve buys government securities, the money supply increases. When other entities purchase government securities, they purchase them from the Federal Reserve, and the money supply decreases. The problem was that the laborers and the farmers saw an increase in their living standard, and the farmers were receiving more for their produce than they had ever gotten in history, and the laborers were receiving high wages. What were they going to do with this money? They sure weren't buying Liberty bonds, which would have decreased the money supply of the country, and they were not putting their new funds in banks that belonged to the Federal Reserve System. Farmers and ranchers of the West and Midwest had much of this money, and they deposited it in small country banks that did not belong to the Federal Reserve System. As prices rose, the money that the workers had accumulated became worth less and less, inflicting upon them an unfair drain, while the property classes were enriched by the inflation because of the increase in the value of land and manufactured goods. The workers were effectively impoverished with inflation, but the farmers, being more self-sufficient, had to be handled more harshly. How was this done? Senator Robert L. Owen, chairman of the Senate Banking and Currency Committee, testified at the Senate Silver Hearings in 1939, told how the Depression of 1920 was carried out. He said that in the early part of 1920, the farmers were exceedingly prosperous. They were paying off mortgages and buying a lot of new land at the instance of the government, and they had borrowed money to do it. And then they were bankrupted by a sudden contraction of credit and currency, which took place in 1920. What took place in 1920 was just the reverse of what should have been taking place. Instead of liquidating the excess of credits created by the war through a period of years, the Federal Reserve Board met in a meeting which was not disclosed to the public. They met on the 18th of May, 1920. It was a secret meeting. They spent all day conferring. The minutes made 60 printed pages, and they appear in Senate Document 310 of February 19, 1923. The Class A directors of the Federal Reserve Advisory Council were present, but the Class B directors who represented business, commerce, and agriculture were not present. The Class C directors representing the people of the United States were not present and were not invited to be present. Only the big bankers were there, and their work of that day resulted in a contraction of credit, which had the effect the next year of reducing the national income $15 billion, throwing millions of people out of employment, and reducing the value of land and ranches by $20 billion. One of the first items on their agenda was to set up a federal farm loan board that encouraged farmers to invest their accrued money in land on long-term loans, which the farmers were eager to do. Mr. Wingo testified, in April, May, June, and July of 1920, the manufacturers and merchants were allowed a very large increase in credits. This was to tide them through the contraction of credit, which was intended to ruin the American farmers, who, during this period, were denied all credit. Eugene Mayer testified at the Senate hearings in 1923 on the primary reason the Federal Reserve Board's action to raise the interest rate to 7% on agricultural and livestock paper was that a great deal of trouble would have been avoided if a larger number of eligible non-member banks had been members of the Federal Reserve System. William Jennings Bryan wrote in Hearst Magazine on November 23, 1923, he said that the Federal Reserve Bank that should have been the farmer's greatest protection has become its greatest foe. The deflation of the farmer was a crime deliberately committed. Challenges came from the Dallas Joint Land and Stock Bank and the Kansas City Joint Land and Stock Bank. Both of these banks were independent institutions and represented the financial needs of the farmers and cattlemen. This challenge ended in 1928 when U.S. Marshals entered both of these banks with drawn pistols and took them over. They were obeying the orders of Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Dewey and Eugene Mayer, Jr. The resulting publicity of this action caused both banks to fail, which left the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and Kansas City in complete control of money and credit in their respective districts. Because of inflation, workers in the United States started striking in 1919. One out of every six people were on strike. Also, prohibition became the law of the land on July 1, 1919, and the working class was outraged. The mafia reappeared because of prohibition. Police in Boston went on strike. Of 1,544 cops, 1,117 walked off the job. Gangs and individuals began looting every store in sight. People were held up in broad daylight. Governor Coolidge of Massachusetts said that there is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, at any time. This statement made him the next president. The American Protective League, along with other former groups that kept tabs on German-American groups during the war, continued this service along with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and went after suspected Bolsheviks. In 1920, over 4,000 people were behind bars in 33 cities. The Treaty for the League of Nations came up for a vote. 49 senators voted yea and 39 voted nay on the League of Nations Treaty. This was 7 votes short of the 2/3 needed for the ratification. But because of the way it was worded, even if it had been passed, Wilson probably would not have signed it. Robert Lansing, U.S. Secretary of State in 1919, said the impression made by it is one of disappointment, regret, and depression. The terms of the peace appear immeasurably harsh and humiliating, while many of them seem to me impossible to perform. The League of Nations, as now constituted, will be the prey of greed and intrigue. When the U.S. Senate approved the Charter of the United Nations in 1945, President Harry S. Truman declared that Woodrow Wilson was vindicated. Well, I'll let you listeners be the judge of that one. Well, once again, my time is up. I guess I've got to go out and feed the chickens, milk the cows, and slop the hogs. Talk to you next time on Money Matters.